Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather around the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show with lots of good people involved. And the host and founder of the program is the one and only Carol Marx. Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she's a champion in the battle against ageism. On today's program, she'll be talking with George Hodgman, a veteran magazine and book editor, and Glenn Cohen, a professor of law at Harvard Law School. We'll also be joined by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman, who's going to talk about a dastardly scam that the telephone companies do to us called cramming and how to watch out for it. But let's kick the program off with yours truly in conversation with an Emmy Award-winning actress and comedian who's most known for the many characters she originated on The Carol Burnett Show and Mama's Family. It is a pleasure to speak with you. I wish it was under better circumstances, but I have to applaud you, Vicki Lawrence, for going out and raising consciousness about a physical malady, I guess you would call it, certainly an annoying one. You'll tell us the details. It's called CIU, and let's see if I can pronounce it properly. It's chronic idiopathic urticaria. Did I get it right?
Very good.
It's also called hives,
wow,
if I'm correct.
Better than I did the first time.
Well, how did this happen? I mean, basically, we're talking about hives, and like everything in today's world.
Yeah, hives, which I don't know, I always thought was, your mother-in-law's nervous breakdown. you marry her son, she breaks out in hives. Or, you know, maybe stress, or, you know, to which I said to the doctor, I'm not stressed out.
And the doctor said to you...
Or, you know, something you've eaten or something you've changed, your detergent or something. But anyway, I got hives about 4 years ago. I woke up with my hands itching. And I remember saying to my husband, go buy a lottery ticket because we're going to win a lot of money tonight. And we laughed about it. But then the next day I woke up with my hands itching again. And then when I went out to walk the dogs, it spread all over my abdomen and my back and my hips. And I walked the dogs home very quickly. And by the time I got back to the house, I had clawed welts all over my body.
Gosh.
And, you know, like I said, you automatically assume it's something you've done that you're allergic to. So you go to the allergist, and he says, yeah, most everybody breaks out in hives at some point in their life. But, you know, for most of us, it comes and goes and never comes back, and we don't think about it again. For me, they didn't go away for 6 weeks, at which point he said, I'm going to diagnose you with chronic idiopathic urticaria. And I had never heard such a thing. I think I laughed the first time he said it because it was such a mouthful.
Mm-hmm.
Come to find out, chronic just means that it's lasted for more than 6 weeks now. And for some people that I've spoken to, it has lasted for years, and they have not found the solution. Idiopathic just means that there's no known cause, and I like to think of idiot as the root word there. And urticaria is like the fancy doctor word for hives. And I, you know, immediately started Googling, looking for information on CIU, and there wasn't any good information out there. There were a lot of people asking questions, but nobody had any answers or direction or any good solid information. So my doctor was able to find a treatment plan for me that has managed my hives, and I've been pretty much hive-free for, I'd say, about 3 years now. So when I was approached by the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America to put this website together, I said, yes, I will gladly throw my hives in the ring and put my face out there and let people know that they're not alone.
Well,
there's a place for them to go and get some good information.
Whenever somebody who has a degree of fame and celebrity encounters something like this, the organizations consider it a potential bonanza because you can go out, put a face on it, and get the word out and raise consciousness. It's a noisy world out there, and you know, the big diseases, the big ailments get all the attention. The smaller ones get lost in the shuffle, not only in terms of public awareness, but even in terms of the drug companies and the medical establishment. Are there drugs being developed?
I feel like in this day and age there should be a place of advocacy for everybody. Yes, there are only 1.5 million of us, but that's quite a few people.
Absolutely.
And they should have a place to go as well.
I agree.
With good, solid information.
I agree. I'm just saying is that that's all part of how this happens. Are there drugs being tested? Is there research going on, or is it just a matter of
throwing hands up in the air? There are a number of good treatment options. The important thing that you're going to learn from the website is that you want to get to an allergist or a dermatologist who deals with CIU, that knows what you're talking about, knows about CIU, and can help you find a treatment option for you that will manage the hives. There are downloadable materials on there so you can track your hives, and it will encourage you to take pictures. So that, because you know how it is in the medical system now, you might not get to the doctor, to the right doctor for 3 or 4 weeks, and you won't get a CIU diagnosis. If indeed that's what it is, you're not going to get that diagnosis for 6 weeks. So you want to be armed with, you know, you want to have plenty of ammunition when you go into, you finally get to the right doctor that you can say, hey, look, this has been going on for 3-4 weeks.
Because this is one of those things that people often say, and we were kidding about it, not really kidding, but we were talking about, you know, the mother-in-law's breakdown, and you break out in a case of hives, stress. There are so many ailments, whether it's colitis, all kinds of diseases that require steroids, that people say it's stress. And stress is one of the things in our lives that is so hard to pinpoint. We all know we have it. It seems to be increasing by the pace at which we're living. You have been in very stressful businesses. You have been in national television shows, a recording artist. I mean, this is all stressful. Has this caused you to do some contemplation about the role of stress in our lives just because it's, you know, it's the elephant in the room?
Well, yeah, and you know what, I learned transcendental meditation a number of years ago, and I will often stop myself and say, okay, you're getting out of control, you know, because it's one of those things that you really need to do it every day, and I'll, you know, lose track of it and then say, you need to get back on that again, because for me, that really helps manage stress, I think.
Are you still doing it?
I do. But like I said, you know, I'll forget or I'll get away from it and I'll be doing okay. And then, you know, when things build up for me, I just find that meditating is like a wonderful thing to de-stress you.
Well,
that and alcohol's nice too. You know what I mean?
You're funny. You know, you were in Hannah, Montana, weren't you? I did not.
I was.
Yeah, that I understand. I mean, I'm so familiar with your work. I even remember playing your song the night the lights went out. In Georgia, was it, or Chicago?
Yes. Uh-huh.
But, yeah. And I thought that was fabulous, but I did not see your work in Hannah, Montana. That was not one of the shows I watched, but just quickly, and I'm going to let you go, and we're going to let everybody know how to find out more information about the CIU. But how do you look back now on your career and changes in entertainment from those days of golden television, or at least relative to today, on the Carol Burnett Show and Mama's Family and those iconic roles that you played and that character you created and having a top 40 hit? How do you look back on those days today as time keeps going on comparative to today's culture?
Oh, just a very special, a very different time. And I think we all realized when we did the first Carol Burnett reunion that the country misses those good old days. And I think, too, you know, the Burnett Show is now out on DVD, as is Mama's Family, as are a lot of the good old shows. And I think it's a testament to those great shows that a lot of the older generation is passing it on to the young kids, and they're loving it just as much. You know, there's a lot of good entertainment back then.
Yeah, it's very, very universal comedy.
It was really the good old days, you know. It was very different.
Well, I'm very happy I'm having the opportunity.
You know, I think of, you were talking about Hannah Montana.
Yeah.
And everybody asks me what is going to happen to Miley Cyrus because I played her grandma on television. I'm supposed to know what's going to happen to her.
Like you are her grandma.
But, you know, I just think, what a world for these young people now with all the social media and the web.
Yeah.
And everything they say, everything they wear, everything they do is up for such scrutiny. And, you're not allowed to be young, make any mistakes, find your way. It's a different world than when I was young.
And which is why I'm surprised everybody doesn't have hives today. I mean, again, just thinking about it, I break out in some kind of a rash. How can people, let's talk about the website real quick so people can get the benefit of your visit on our program. Where should people go? Tell me if I'm correct. Is it the website CIUandU.com? Is that
exactly right?
Okay, so folks, it's CIUandU.com,
supported by the Allergy and Asthma Foundation of America and made possible by Genentech and Novartis. It's a great website, a lot of good people that know what they're talking about, a lot of good materials there. Get there, and if you think this is you and you're itching, check it out.
And there you have it, a conversation I had with Vicki Lawrence about her hives. And you notice in the conversation she admitted and revealed that one of the things she does to avoid stress is to meditate. And that's a nice non-drug way of reducing stress and reducing the ill effects of so many of these mysterious things that ail us in this modern world as we're all out there with our noses to the grindstone and multitasking and trying to keep all those plates on those poles spinning without having one fall down. It does wear down your health. Vicki Lawrence, great talking to her. Up next, Carol Marks. I'm Michael Harrison. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. It is important to address a personal emergency response system in your home in case of falls or injuries. AARP encourages their use for many older Americans to enhance independence and security, especially for those living alone. Many brands of PERS are available on the market, and seniors should consider their specific needs and budget before deciding on a system. The Federal Trade Commission provides free online information. One can get a system as basic as wearing a necklace or bracelet and push a button that will transmit to an installed response center through your landline telephone. In the event of an emergency with falls, chest pain, a suspected intruder, a press of the button will have a 911 ambulance dispatched to your home, even if you cannot reach your phone. PERS systems can be rented or purchased through local hospitals and are affordable and serviced by representatives. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and now the host of the program, front and center, Carol Marks, in conversation with George Hodgman. He's a veteran magazine and book editor who's worked at Simon & Schuster, Vanity Fair, and Talk magazine. He's going to talk about his new book titled Bettyville, published by Viking. It's a memoir about what it means to care for an older parent, to come home to small-town America, and to be part of a family.
The whole story that goes into your memoir started when you went back to the little town of Paris, which in Missouri, and it's very small, 1,246 people, and you went back for your mother's birthday. And then you found out that she lost her driver's license because she had a fender bender. And that, you know, is always terribly unnerving for anyone to lose their license because that's your independence. But why was it even worse for somebody that lived in a small town like Paris?
Well, I mean, in a small town, you can't take the bus. You can't, you know, get on the subway. You can't. I mean, you really have to drive in a small town. And you have to not only drive to, you know, the places you need to go in town, but there are so many things that you need to do in other larger towns that are close by, whether it's going to the doctor or, in my mother's case, playing bridge. My mother's a fierce bridge player. And also it was just central to my mother, to the woman that I knew, to sort of control her destiny through movement. You know, she's a very don't fence me in kind of person. And she always wanted to be going somewhere on the road. And so it was a hard blow.
It surely was. And, you know, you stayed with your mother and you had to, you know, help her out with a lot of things. And you thought early on, well, you know, I can go back to New York after a few months if you could get your mother on a waiting list for assisted living center. So what happened? Because I guess she wasn't able to do that.
Well, I didn't ever want to put order in the assisted living center. Even though we found a very nice one, and there are many other very nice ones, I didn't really ever want to go there because I knew that my mother and I are very sentimental about home and about our home, and I didn't want her to lose her home, and I didn't want to lose it either. And so I didn't ever make a decision, oh, I'll move here. But I just sort of day at a time, you know, week at a time, month at a time, stayed. And as her situation changed, our options in terms of the kind of care that she could have gotten if she had moved out of the house changed. And they were situations that would have been, you know, even harder for her.
And you were able to get somebody that you knew in to help during the day. And
yes.
When you decided, you know, that you were going to stay in Paris and be your mother's caretaker, how hard was it for you? Because you were had been in New York in recovery from substance abuse, and you were gay, and so to leave it and all the people that, you know, had sustained you in your recovery, and to leave your friends must have been very difficult. And weren't you also worried about, you know, the kind of work that you could do in Paris, because you did need to keep busy and bring in some income? So you had some concerns.
Yeah, I mean, if you're dealing with old age, income is always a part of the picture, isn't it? I mean, we're all...
Definitely.
We're all worried about our people being able to, you know, sustain themselves. And yeah, moving here presented a lot of issues, and being here did. One thing I have to say about this book is that, you know, I'm not trying to put myself out there as special, because everybody, you know, there are zillions of people out there taking care of kids and mothers and, you know, people with special needs or whatever. What this book shows, and what I'm trying to put forward, and this kind of goes to your question, is that, I mean, the biggest problem I faced was fear, because I'm an only child, and I was this New York guy who only cared about, you know, I was career driven, and you know, I didn't cook. My idea of cooking was pick up the telephone and talk to a Chinese person. And you know, this is kind of a book for people who, you think, I think I can never do this. And because I had such fear, I didn't.
You're right. Because don't you think that we all have this fear that none of us talk about? We are afraid of change, no matter what form it takes. We definitely.
Well, I think sometimes we're afraid of being around older people, because it reminds us of the fact that life is life, and I think I was just afraid that. I mean, there were all kinds of things that I didn't think I could pull off. I didn't, you know, she didn't really like the food that I cooked at the beginning. And, I mean, all the stuff that, I mean, you have to, being older is a job. You have to take care of all the insurance things and taxes and, you know, all these trips to doctors, keeping the, I mean, it's almost a job to coordinate the various activities of the various doctors. And, you know, I just didn't know that whether I could step up to the plate and handle this as well as she deserved.
And you certainly did. Not easy, but you show that we can do it if we have the right outlook. Now, not only did your mother change because she was showing some signs of dementia and physical decline, but you write so well about something that really bothers me, and that's the way rural towns have changed in America. And you said that three things have changed, and you want to tell our listeners what they were, because they are important, and in a way I find them devastating.
Well, I think this is from a very good book that I read. There are three things that have really changed rural America. One, the death of the family farm to Walmart, which destroyed the merchant class of the town, which, you know, economically changed a town. Without the merchants, you don't have people who contribute to the churches and, you know, do civic activities, and Walmart pays rock-bottom wages. And three, Missouri is an example of this, and is the meth epidemic. Missouri is the number one state for meth, and, I mean, I don't see a huge amount of evidence of a drug issue around this town, but there is in the state.
You know, did it touch your family because you found what in your grandmother's house that the owners that were there at one point had a meth lab, and that's certainly kind of an unnerving thing. You know, one of the things that I thought was so well done in your book was really the talking about your parents and the emotional issues. And, you know, your parents, like so many people, really struggled with words. A lot of things weren't said. There were a lot of secrets in your family. There certainly were in mine. And so they never brought up the fact that you were gay, and you didn't bring it up either. And, you know, that must have been, you know, something that bothered you.
It was, I mean, we had such a good, loving relationship, and they gave me so much. And I think that when, you know, you think you're not going to talk about these things and it's not going to matter, you think you can kind of put things under a rock and you can avoid things. And I, you know, it seems to me that coming back here at this point in my life has taught me that we really did pay something for our silence. And in this, spending this time with my mother in her last years, I do wish that we could have been more open with each other.
That's George Hodgman in conversation with Carol Marx. His book is titled Bettyville, and it's published by Viking. Carol Marx returns later in the program. She'll be talking with Glenn Cohen, a professor of law at Harvard University, about his new book, Patients with Passports, Medical Tourism, Law, and Ethics, published by Oxford University Press. We'll also be joined by Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues. Michael Harrison here with you on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. Very proud to be with you on this program. This program has been on the air in one form or another consistently now for over two decades. Kind of runs below the radar. It's heard on weekends on great talk radio stations around the country. And what I'm really proud about in terms of this program, in which I have the opportunity to serve as anchor, not as host. Carol Marx is the host, and I certainly am not the only voice on this show. We have a roundtable of outstanding personalities, experts, and broadcasters. What I love about this show is that in an industry marked by concern, focus, obsession with youth, and believe me, I'm about as young thinking as anybody you'll meet. Sometimes I'm even accused of being immature. But and so I'm all for that, and I'm all for looking ahead. But I'm also for fairness, and I'm also for respect. And the media in America, driven by, obviously, Madison Avenue and commercial concerns, focuses primarily on young people. And if somebody's over 50 or 55 or 60, they quite often find that there's a lot lacking in terms of what's available in the mainstream media. So this program, which was conceived and developed by Carol Marx more than 20 years ago, originally was called Senior Focus, and it evolved into A Touch of Gray, and I became involved with it along the way, as something that really provides a service in as much as it unashamedly, unabashedly, unapologetically brings information to people via this wonderful medium of radio that is of use, of interest, of service, of comfort, of support to people over 50 years of age. and their families, which is why I say at the beginning of the program, children of all ages, because so many people in their 50s find themselves in a situation that has been kind of accurately and colorfully termed the sandwich generation, meaning they have children, adult children, still living with them, and abiding by the rule that came down a long time ago, honor thy father and thy mother, they have their parents living with them. In many cases, these parents are in their 80s, 90s, and are living at home. And the amount of pressure that can be put on somebody dealing with adult children and senior parents all under one roof is extraordinary, and it's a phenomenon that in many ways I applaud. I'm all for families staying together. But also, there are people who are in need of support and information. So in many ways, A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, is in fact a program for children of all ages. But I salute Carol Marks. I think that she has done and continues to do a remarkable job. And she does it under sometimes the worst of conditions because, like the rest of us, she's not getting any younger either. But she drives herself to research and get the information needed and select guests and topics. And not only that, she travels around the world and brings information from other countries on how their healthcare systems operate and how the services that they provide for senior citizens there are taken care of and done. And she brings that information back, not to mention she acts as a model, as a role model for people to get up and get out and live life and do things. And she's done everything from, she's explored, you know, if there were four corners on this planet, as the saying goes, she's been to all four of them. Check her out at the website, atouchofgray.com. Gray is spelled with an E. And I just wanted to mention that she is one fine lady, and we're grateful to be involved with her in this project.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. The National Institute of Mental Health reports elderly depression to be a serious public health problem. Recent research shows 15% of persons over 60, or roughly 6.5 million Americans, are suffering from depression, while 25% state they suffer from sadness. Health practitioners that care and treat the elderly, including primary care physicians, are unprepared to detect and diagnose depression. Let's review depression's warning signs. Are you experiencing feelings of helplessness or sadness, most of the time lasting 2 weeks or longer? Have family members, friends noticed social withdrawal, self-neglect with personal hygiene, appearance, clothing, loss of appetite, weight loss, and maybe dehydration? Has your physical pain increased? Has there been a major loss, illness, or surgery recently? If any of these scenarios exist, an evaluation by a qualified MD is recommended. Successful treatment of depression would include both psychotherapy and medications. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We're joined at this point in the program by our senior correspondent, Kevin Casey, whose day job happens to be vice president and executive editor of the trade magazine Talkers, which serves the talk radio industry at talkers.com. Well, Kevin, we are past Memorial Day. We're heading toward the 4th of July weekend. It's warming up. The summer is here. It's time for soda, pretzels, and beer, and lots of names in the news on talk radio, including the names Clinton and Bush. Can we live without a Clinton or a Bush in our life on talk radio?
Well, you know, it's funny. It dawned on me the other day as we were thinking about what's going on in talk radio, and their Clintons have been in the news literally since 1991. The Bushes, going back to
1980.
I mean, we actually do have still political dynasties in this country.
And yet, you know, it makes you wonder why. First of all, the Republicans have never elected a ticket since 1980. That didn't have a Bush on it. You had the first President Bush as vice president for a couple of terms, and he was president for a term, and then he ran again. And then, of course, George W. did two terms. You've got Jeb Bush now, probably one of, if not the leading Republican contenders at this early stage. Hillary Clinton, It was funny. I was looking at some old videos of me on C-SPAN from 1994, and we were talking about the most talked about people of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most talked about people of 1994, number one was Bill Clinton, but one of the top ten was Hillary Rodham Clinton.
That's right. Remember when we used to call her Rodham?
That's right. It was Hillary Rodham Clinton. And you don't hear that. She dumped that one pretty quickly. It seemed to offend people who thought that she was a harsh feminist at that time. Now she's a harsh right winger. Well, if you really look at the track records of people and you get rid of the labels, you've got some people on the Republican in the Republican Party who are to the left of Hillary.
There's no question about it. In fact, one of the things that some people, depending upon how you feel about Hillary Clinton becoming the next president, say that what she has going for her is that she's actually fairly conservative for a Democrat. She's in war terms, she's very hawkish. She is far to the right of most of the Democrats.
And that's the complaint in the Democratic primary
right.
race. That's why the dye-in-the-wool Democrats or liberals are, making Bernie Sanders such a hero at this point.
Oh, sure.
It's very interesting. We only have about 50 seconds, so I'm going to leave it with this thought. Somewhere in our DNA, we human beings love to have royalty. I mean, we fought a revolutionary war to get away from the King of England, but we love dynasties because there really is, with all of the millions and millions and millions of people that live in this country and a supposedly democratically elected president, for it to be dynasties is a mathematical anomaly that only can be attributed to the fact that, I guess, we just like having royal families, and we have them whether we like it or not. You get the final word.
If people like what they know, and people, if they believe someone is going to be successful because they're in the same family, then they'll vote for them again and again.
Thank you for joining us, folks. If you want to know what's going on in talk radio, Kevin Casey joins us on a regular basis here on the program, and talkers.com is the place to go. I'm Michael Harrison. A Touch of Gray continues in a moment.
Retrievers, Labradors, Goldens are the main breeds that come through our door, but we'll train anything with four legs and a tail. My husband and I train hunting dogs and also have a boarding and grooming business. And our dogs, they're athletes, and we feed them very quality food. You can't get enzymes in a commercial dog food because they cook it at such a high heat, but adding Dynavite to their diet has every single dog in my kennel looking better than they have ever looked.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Dynavite's the bomb.
Tell everybody we know about Dynavite.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite. If it's working, don't quit.
When I get down to the bottom of my box of Dynavite, it's time to place my order.
Dynavite.com.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com. For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. You may recognize the symptoms of elderly depression, loss of appetite, weight loss, social withdrawal, problems with hygiene, neglecting personal well-being, or even a sadness that lasts over 2 weeks. Sound familiar? Here's what you can do about it. Exercise, eat well, and don't forget to socialize. Researchers at Duke University suggest exercising at least 3 times a week to keep the body and mind healthy. That means swimming, walking, and maybe light exercise classes with the approval of your medical doctor. Another key to happiness is maintaining self-esteem through clubs and groups. You might consider the gardening club or a musical choir. And lastly, treat your body well, and it will thank you by feeling well. That means practicing good nutrition and eating well-balanced meals daily. Naturally, the needs of patients vary, but feel free to consult a geriatric specialist to make a personalized treatment plan. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host of the program, Carol Marks, in conversation with Glenn Cohen, professor of law at Harvard Law School, and he has a new book titled Patients with Passports, Medical Tourism, Law, and Ethics, published by Oxford University Press.
Was your interest in medical tourism influenced both by the increasing media reports about it and your own personal experiences.
Yes, that's exactly right. So I first started noticing it maybe in 2003, 2004, when we started seeing CNN and others reporting on it. But then my mother actually became a medical tourist herself. I'm a Canadian by origin, although I've been living here for a long time in the States. But my mother decided not to wait for a hip replacement in Canada. And also they did a different method in the United States that was not yet available in Canada at the time, with a much shorter waiting period. So I'd like to think about, I approach this both as an academic and as a son.
Now, I want to start out by asking you for a good definition for medical tourism. And do we have any idea how many Americans are going to go abroad for medical care this year or went last year?
Yeah, so let me start with a definition because that's a little bit easier. I think the best definition is when someone travels from one country, their home country, their country of origin, to another country, the destination country, for the primary purpose of securing care. So that definition excludes, for example, people who get sick while on vacation or while living abroad in a working capacity. So I'm really interested in people who travel to get care. In terms of estimates from the United States, they're really all over the place. Deloitte estimated at one point, the consultants, that 750,000 U.S. patients traveled abroad in 2007 for inpatient and outpatient care. McKinsey in 2008 thought that number was way too high. And in any event, Deloitte now estimates that in the foreseeable future, a ceiling would be 1.6 U.S. medical tourists. 1.6 million U.S. medical tourists going abroad. But again, all of these numbers are soft. We really don't have a good way of tracking this because people don't tell us why they're traveling. And part of it depends on your definition. You know, some of these definitions in these studies exclude dental tourism. Does going abroad to fill a prescription, does that count or not? So we don't really know, but I think they're probably thinking about 1.6 million a year as the ceiling for the foreseeable future probably is the high end.
Now, is it fair to say that to date, most U.S. Medical tourists appear to be uninsured or underinsured, so they're really going because they want to have some substantial cost savings by traveling to a country where it would be less expensive?
That's exactly right. So either there are people without health insurance, so that's changing a little bit with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, or they're underinsured. By underinsured, we mean people who have health insurance but have high deductibles, co-pays, or the like, or for some other reason, it's more fitting for them and more effective for them to go abroad and pay out of pocket. But as I think your question hints, we're seeing increasing experimentation by Fortune 500 companies and other large companies with trying to incorporate this into insurance. Although to date, most of the people who've gone from the U.S. have been uninsured or underinsured.
And I think, though, that, you know, how the maybe our states and self-insured firms and the 500 companies and all our domestic insurers are going to kind of grab on to medical tourism because it's going to be very financially profitable for them, and they're going to give, you know, great incentives for people to go abroad. So I would think that, you know, both the insurer and the patient may have a win-win situation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's certainly the possibility. And so most of the big insurers and many large Fortune 500 companies have looked into this. Some of them have implemented it. Others are still considering and seeing how the market moves. But as you say, you know, when you look at a cardiac bypass, an angioplasty, a hip replacement, if someone goes to India, to Thailand, Singapore, to Mexico, you're talking, even from the insurer's perspective, of saving anywhere from 40 to 80% of their costs, what they would pay themselves. And you figure the insurer is saving all that money. They can afford to give an incentive payment to pay for a companion to travel with the individual, to give the individual time off work. And indeed, we're seeing this. ABC News, and I mentioned this, I think it was quoted in the story, reports on a company in North Carolina that was sending patients to Costa Rica or giving them the option of going to Costa Rica for gastric bypass, for example. And not only were they waiving deductibles, paying for the time off, paying for a companion, paying for the care, but offering them a check, actual hard money to go abroad and do this. So there's a possibility of the win-win situation, although, as you know from the rest of the book, I have some, there's some issues with the industry in terms of malpractice, in terms of quality, and the like, that might make this, in particular cases, not such a win for the individual.
And your book also covers the legal and illegal medical treatments that medical tourists seek. And isn't it true that some medical treatments are legal in one country and not in another? So what are the legal and ethical questions that these different legal requirements in different countries can raise? And what can they lead to? Because I think people need to be aware of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. So the main examples of this, I call this circumvention tourism, when something is illegal at home in the home country, but legal in the destination country, and you try to circumvent, if you will, the legal regime. So the main examples I talk about are travel for abortion. So from places like Poland or Portugal, for example, to places like the Netherlands, travel for assisted suicide. So although assisted suicide is now legal in many places, Switzerland is the only place where it's legal without requiring you to be a resident. So actually, you know, more than 100 people from the UK have traveled to Switzerland for assisted suicide. And some of the questions that have been raised are, if a family member accompanies you and comes back to the UK after you've passed, can that person be charged with assisting in a suicide? There's also a very widespread travel for fertility. As you know, in the U.S., we have commercial surrogacy in places like California in particular, whereas much of the world, especially in Europe, doesn't allow commercial surrogacy. So you have people who travel to us in California from France, for example, and they try to bring their children back, the ones that are born through the surrogate in the U.S., and the French government has struggled with whether it will recognize their citizenship and their parenthood. And there have also been people who've been, these children sometimes get stuck in places like India where a lot of fertility tourism takes place because of, again, differences in the legal regime, and these children become almost stateless at some point. And then there's also, I talk in the book about people who travel for experimental therapies and are not really illegal so much as unapproved. And here you have parents, for example, taking children to China for stem cell therapies where they promise helping everything from autism to baldness to cystic fibrosis, and many of these treatments are dangerous. There's not a lot of good evidence that they work. They're not collecting the data. And here I talk, among other things, about the question about whether parents who take their children abroad for this may be engaged in abuse or neglect, and whether social services and doctors have an obligation to report and try to intervene when some of these treatments are dangerous. So there's a lot of very interesting questions with the circumvention tourism.
Interesting ethical questions. Now, when it comes to trying to pick a good hospital or doctor in another country for a particular medical procedure, is the website for the Joint Commission International, is that a good place to start?
I think it is a good place to start. So the Joint Commission International is affiliated with the Joint Commission, who is the body that basically certifies and accredits U.S. hospitals in order for them to get access to Medicare funding, which is most hospitals in the U.S. It has a pretty elaborate certification system, but all the certification is really procedural. It's not about outcome. It's about, you know, do you have this in place? Do you have that in place? Which is good and helpful, but, you know, even within the United States, where all our hospitals are Joint Commission accredited, essentially, you see very wide disparities in terms of outcomes from one hospital to the other. And what I tell people is it's very expensive to get Joint Commission accredited. It's very thorough. They're great. And one thing that signals to you, if a particular country has invested, and it means that to get the Joint Commission accreditation, the Joint Commission International, it means the very least that they're standing behind this hospital. They view it as their flagship. And if something goes wrong with your care, they probably will face a little bit more pressure to try to make things right with you than non-accredited hospitals. But again, even though they're Joint Commission accredited, that's a good starting point, but it probably doesn't tell you enough. The biggest problem, though, is it's very hard to get the kind of data you really would want to make good choices. That's true in the United States as well, where most people don't have access to the kind of information on the quality of care. And it turns out even when we provide people with information, they tend to rely more on word of mouth anyways. But I think starting with the list of Joint Commission accredited hospitals is a good starting point. But then I think you need to dig deeper and kind of ask more questions, see what kind of answers you're going to get.
That's Glenn Cohen in conversation with Carol Marks. The book is titled Patients with Passports, Medical Tourism, Law and Ethics, published by Oxford University Press. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. New guidelines from the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism for persons 65 and older reveal that if women drink more than 7 drinks per week or greater than 3 drinks per occasion, and men 14 drinks per week or greater than 4 drinks per occasion, you're at risk for illness or injury. As the body ages, the tolerance to alcoholic beverages decreases. Literally, at 65 and older, you're unable to process alcoholic beverages as, say, a person that is 45. Alcoholic overuse and intolerance can worsen mental confusion, problems with balance and falls, depressive disorders, dehydration, inadequate nutrition, adverse interaction with some medications, and can lead to social isolation. One drink is 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, or 1.5 ounces of liquor, or the amount in a shot glass. Are you ready to acknowledge that at age 65 and older, that fewer than 7 drinks per week or 1 drink per day is the limit and offers you the advantages of leading a healthier and safer lifestyle? I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
When we ran out, we stopped using it.
Why would you stop?
Why undo all the good that's been accomplished? We thought everything was fine, and that was not a good thing.
No.
He started stinking. It was awful.
Shedding comes back, loss of hair, lots of dandruff.
Scratching will return. His shedding will increase.
If I ever took Roy off of Dynavite, he would go back to his hair loss.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
When I get down to the bottom of my box of Dynavite,
when I get to about 3/4,
oh no, I've got a couple more scoops.
It's time to place my order. Dynavite.com.
Each and every day she is getting a Dynavite.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite. If it's working, don't quit.
Don't do what I did and run out.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, we come to the final segment of the hour. I'm Michael Harrison, and we're joined by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman. He's an attorney, he's an author, he's a prolific author, and he's also one of the nation's leading experts on scams. His website is scamaside.com. He's also written Identity Theft Alert, published by Prentice Hall. And Steve joins us now to talk about the dastardly process known as cramming. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that's the CFPB, has announced that it reached settlements with wireless service providers Sprint and Verizon recently regarding allegations by the CFPB that both of these companies were guilty of cramming. And the CFPB has asked the federal courts for approval of these settlements. Now, I've been warning you for years about the dangers of cramming. Cramming is the name for putting unauthorized third-party charges on a consumer's telephone bill without the knowledge or approval of the consumer. It's long been a problem with landline phones, and in recent years has become a major problem with cell service. There are a lot of ways these unauthorized charges make their way to your phone bill. Sometimes consumers actually unknowingly sign up for premium texting services that may be for such things as flirting tips, horoscopes, or celebrity gossip. Other times, you'll actually have unscrupulous merchants who will trick consumers into providing their cell phone number, to which these merchants add the charges without providing anything in return. Now, the charges can range from a single monthly charge of up to $14.99 to regular continuous monthly charges of about $9.99 per month. A lot of consumers don't even notice these charges in their bills, and they're often not very clearly designated. So it may look like it's just a regular part of your phone bill. Let's face it, our phone bills today, you need a code book to be able to decode them. Now, both Sprint and Verizon, although they didn't do the actual cramming, they weren't putting these charges on there. They cooperated with this, and they would receive between 30% and 40% of the revenue generated by these illegal charges. Now, pursuant to the terms of these settlements, Sprint and Verizon will refund $120 million to affected customers, as well as pay $38 million in federal and state fines. So, first and foremost, even if you are not a Sprint or Verizon customer, everyone should closely review their cell phone bill each month to make sure you understand every charge that appears. If anything's not clear to you, you should contact the cell phone service provider for an explanation. If you are a Verizon customer who's been victimized by cramming, you can submit a claim for a refund by going to www.cfppssettlementverizon.com or by calling 888-726-7063. If you're a Sprint customer who's been victimized by cramming, you can submit a claim for a refund by going to www.sprintrefundpsms.com or call 877-389-8787.
Thank you, Steve Wiseman. Very, very interesting. Kind of scary stuff, isn't it? Be sure to check out scamaside.com, his website, and The Truth About Avoiding Scams and Identity Theft Alert, two books published by Prentice Hall, written by our very own Steve Wiseman. Thank you, Kevin Casey, for joining us. And, of course, thank you, Beverly Santinello, our producer. And a big thanks to Carol Marks, the host and founder of the program. On behalf of all of us, I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us here next weekend for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.